Hey, thanks for inviting me into your home. Long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room. You know, with the authentic wood paneling, the shag carpeting, and the air hockey table. Your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada affiliate In-Depth Radio News Talk 1010. Last night, or earlier this morning, for those of you keeping score at home, Matt Swain was here sharing more tales of haunted rock and roll. Lots of fun. If you like that sort of thing, you should check out my new podcast, incidentally, The Rock and Roll Twilight Zone. But if you were listening, you may have noticed we got bumped off the air just about the time Matt and I were talking about the curse of the crossroads. That's the Robert Johnson deal with the devil legend. And I think I mentioned it last night, but it's worth repeating. It's so strange. This is the third time things have gone wonky, haywire, where electronics have malfunctioned whenever I discuss the crossroads, the legend of the crossroads. It happened last night, as I say. It happened when Matt was on my podcast. We recorded pre-recorded an interview. I listened back to the interview, and there was this strange crackling sound throughout the interview that wasn't there in my headset when we were doing it. Our Gary Patterson was on my weekly radio show a couple of years ago, The Conspiracy Show, and it was one of the last interviews I did with him on the radio, and he was telling the story of his pilgrimage down to the crossroads in Clarksdale, Mississippi, where old Highway 161 intersects with old Highway 49. And he went down there with some of his fraternity brothers, and they were there to gather up some dirt from the side of the road, and they took it home, and then all hell broke loose. One of his friends had a heart attack, another had an aneurysm, all within hours of arriving home. So we're talking about this on the radio, and all of a sudden, my computer just shuts down, like someone yanked the power cord from the wall. And then Gary's phone was disconnected, and eventually we got him back on the air. But there you go. We're all... We were going to talk rock and roll again tonight, or we are going to talk rock and roll again tonight, but more specifically, we're going to delve into classic rock. We'll stay clear of the crossroads and Robert Johnson, lest we tempt fate a fourth time. Steve Hyden is a rock journalist, and like me and many of you, I'm sure, a fan of classic rock. And in case you hadn't noticed, a number of classic rock acts are winding things down in 2018. Paul Simon, Elton John, Lynyrd Skynyrd, possibly Deep Purple, are all embarking on their final tours. And in the last couple of years, we've lost some legends: David Bowie, Glenn Frey, Tom Petty, Prince, Gord Downie, for you fans up here of the Tragically Hip. How much longer will the Rolling Stones and Paul McCartney, the Moody Blues, the Zombies, Robert Plant, Roger Daltrey, how much longer will they be with us? Hard to imagine. But our rock and roll icons, heroes, classic rock gods, are not immortal. Yes, they will be sadly missed. There will come a day when they're all gone or retired. And then what? To some of us, it's almost unthinkable. A world without Paul McCartney or Mick or Keith. Contemplating the end of classic rock is the subject of Steve Hyden's new book, Twilight of the Gods: A Journey to the End of Classic Rock, and he joins me in hour one. The final 3 hours of the program, again, if you're like me and you find the whole UFO arena absolutely fascinating, but also more than a little complex, you'll want to stick around for my conversation with James T. Abbott, who tackles the world of ufology as an outsider, which is kind of refreshing. If you spend any time at UFO conferences or interacting with the regular UFO crowd, you'll quickly discover what a viper's nest it can be. It's all, why are you talking with that person? Don't you know they're a disinfo agent? And why did you interview that person? He's a muppet, a mind-controlled puppet. James T. Abbott isn't part of that crowd. He's a skeptic who just loves research. He has no vested interests. He presents his findings without fear or favor. He's like most of us, an outsider. And that's the name of his book, The Outsider's Guide to UFOs. And over the course of 3 hours, we're going to delve into his research and take a look at some of the 40 most important UFO cases, some of the 9 official projects and reports on the subject, and some of the 13 fascinatingly strange UFO characteristics. And I can't wait for this. He'll reveal his outsider's perspective on 20 possible explanations for UFOs. I mean, what are these things? We seem to be glued to this supposition that these are craft of extraterrestrial origin, piloted by some advanced alien civilization. Is that the only possibility? The Outsider's Guide to UFOs, Volume 1, Mystery and Science, in the final 3 hours of the program. Of course, you'll jump in at some point, dear Coast listeners, with your usual brilliance. Now, this show wasn't intended to be a theme show, but now I'm thinking, is it possible that the band UFO just might be classic rock's best-kept secret? Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Stephen Hayden is the author of Your Favorite Band is Killing Me. His writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Washington Post, Billboard, Pitchfork, Rolling Stone, Grantland, the AV Club, Slate, and Salon. He's currently the cultural critic at UpRocks and the host of the Celebration Rock podcast. He lives in Minnesota with his wife and two children, and his latest book is Twilight of the Gods and the Future of Classic Rock. Steve Hayden, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I am great. How are you?
Terrific. Thank you. We should start with a definition. What do you consider to be classic rock? Because I listen to certain classic rock stations, and their record universe is sort of defined as anything after Rubber Soul, let's say 1965, and everything up to including, Born to Run in 1975. What do you consider to be classic rock?
Well, when I was growing up and listening to classic rock radio, it was music that basically started, like, as you say, around like the late 60s. I would say Sgt. Pepper is the beginning of that, because if you listen to oldies radio, for instance, they would play early Beatles stuff like I Want to Hold Your Hand and She Loves You. And then once you get into the later Beatles, that's where you get into the classic rock radio area. It's funny, as the audience for this music has aged, how the definition has expanded a little bit, whereas now you'll hear bands from the 90s on classic rock radio stations. So you'll hear Led Zeppelin, and then you'll hear Pearl Jam, and then maybe Smashing Pumpkins after that, and then into The Who. Basically, in the book, I really sort of look at the radio as being the definer of this, because classic rock as a concept, it really didn't exist until it was invented as a radio format in the 1980s. And that was what codified a certain generation of bands as being classic rock.
Now, you're quite a bit younger than I am. You were born in 1977. So yeah. By the time you were born, a lot of the top classic rock performers were either long dead, Brian Jones and Jimi Hendrix, the 27 Club, Janis, and so forth, or a lot of the classic rock acts they'd either broken up if they were a band, or they had basically stopped being relevant. They hadn't recorded anything noteworthy in quite some time. So how did you become a fan of this genre? Why not, Hungarian choral music or rap, or, pick your genre? Why classic rock for such a young man?
Well, I didn't say I didn't love Hungarian choral music too. Maybe that'll be my next book.
Can't wait.
Exactly. No, as for classic rock, there's a lot of books about classic rock, and normally the perspective on this music comes from people who grew up with it, people of the baby boom generation, people that were at Woodstock or that, saw these albums as they were being released. But I think there's actually there's another audience, and I think a very big audience, who are people my age and even younger who came to this music through the radio. And what makes this generation, I think, really unique is the fact that, in a way, in terms of sort of their cultural profile, a lot of these bands sort of remain fixed in time, where you could be someone like me who started really kind of becoming a music fan in the early 90s. And, and I loved alternative rock, I loved gangster rap, I loved all of the contemporary music. But the classic rock stuff, it was just as accessible. You just had to turn the radio dial a couple of spaces to the left or right, and you would hear all of this music being played all the time. You would hear Hotel California, you know, more than it was played even at its peak in the 70s. So I actually feel like it's a pretty common phenomenon. I mean, it's true that, like, I was I started listening to, like, Led Zeppelin 10 years after they broke up. But I can honestly say that I grew up with their music, not only because I bought the records, but because that music was in my life, you know, because of the radio. And also just from being, like, in at, like, football stadiums and in shopping malls and gas stations. You know, we've kept these bands alive, I think, in that way.
Steve Hyden is with us, the author of Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. Now, like you, I mean, I feel like I'm in a bit of a race with The Undertaker. I don't mean to sound so morose, but, you know, I want to get out and I want to see the legends before, and that's all I have time for. You know, I'm just going to see the legends. And I try to take my, I have twin boys that are 11. We went to see the Moody Blues when they performed for, the, you know, celebrating the 50th anniversary of Days of Future Past. And we went out to see the Zombies when they were performing with the original members when they were playing, you know, track for track, the Odyssey and Oracle. But how do you, I mean, the purists say, you know, if you go to see The Who when they're doing their residency in Las Vegas at Caesar's Palace, and there's only two of the four original members, that's not seeing The Who. How do you respond to that?
Well, on one hand, yeah, that's right. I mean, you're not seeing The Who in their classic form. You're not seeing Keith Moon, John Entwistle. I mean, you're basically missing the rhythm section of the band. On the other hand, you know, if you love this music and this is the best thing that you have, I think people are willing to take the best thing that they can have or that they can get. I mean, one thing that we're seeing now, that I write about in the book is this experience of, like, classic rock groups almost starting to melt together, you know, because of people, of band members passing away or retiring or quitting or whatever the case may be. You know, a very obvious example that happened recently is with Fleetwood Mac, where Lindsey Buckingham either quit or he was fired from the band, and they hired Mike Campbell from Tom Petty's band, the Heartbreakers, to replace him, as well as Neil Finn from the Australian band Crowded House. And, of course, Mike Campbell needs a job because Tom Petty is no longer with us, and Fleetwood Mac needs a guitar player who has a background in California, you know, rock music. So it's like a marriage of convenience. We can take this guy and we can use him to go out on the road. And, you know, Fleetwood Mac, of course, they have a history of, like, switching out members and remaking themselves for different eras. But, you know, I think it's different now in the sense that, like, when Fleetwood Mac recruited Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks in the mid-70s, and they became this sort of gargantuan band after that. You know, I think back then there was a sense of, like, creative rebirth, you know, that we're bringing in these people because we're going to start a new era. Whereas now, like, when AC/DC hires Axl Rose, you know, to be the new lead singer, or when the Grateful Dead recruit John Mayer to be new Jerry Garcia, it's like we need these people to just stay on the road, you know, so we can continue to sort of service this market for our music. And, you know, that makes it sound cynical, maybe. Maybe there's a little bit of cynicism there. But at the same time, people are going to celebrate this music that they've loved for so long. And I think if you're in the audience for these shows, it's hard to be critical of that. I mean, there's nothing really wrong with that, especially if you're not, like, hiding the fact that Lindsey Buckingham isn't there. If Mike Campbell were wearing a Lindsey Buckingham disguise, I would say maybe that was, like, deceptive or something. But people know what's happening going into these situations, and they're still willing to pay top dollar to see these bands.
Lynyrd Skynyrd on their farewell tour, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Gary Rosington is the only original member left. I mean, why not just pay half price and go see a tribute band? Or one-third of the price. I mean, that is being cynical. But I guess the question is, are we so... I mean, because I would go see Lynyrd Skynyrd, even if it's just Gary Rosington, or it, you know, it turns out to be Gary Rosington's podiatrist and Ronnie Van Zant's second cousin, you know, because I just, you want to be in the same room, breathing the same air with white, like-minded people who have the same frames of reference. But are we so desperate to sort of to hold on to the past? Are we allowing classic rock to take up maybe too much emotional room in our lives?
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting point here. Again, it gets to the idea of, like, what makes a band a band? You know, is it is it one original member? Is it two original members? You know, some people would say no. It's, you know, if you lose anyone, then you're not the same band anymore. I mean, these are really brands as much as bands. You know, they represent something as strong as, like, Coca-Cola or Levi's does. And what's going to be interesting, I think, moving forward is how those brands are going to survive there being no original members, you know, like when, if there's still an audience in there, what happens then? Are we going to enter an era of hologram tours? You know, that's something I'm really fascinated by. You know,
yes.
Frank Zappa, there's going to be a Frank Zappa hologram tour that's been in the works. I think that's going to be later this year. I mean, they announced it already. It'll be interesting to see how that goes. You know, I think now people have sort of a knee-jerk repulsion towards that idea. You know, like Justin Timberlake got in a lot of trouble when there were rumors that he was going to perform with a Prince hologram during the Super Bowl. There's this idea that it's like sort of, exploitive and gross, you know, that we're sort of like, it's almost like necrophilia in a way, you know,
right,
picking up these people. But I, you know, I think all that has to happen, Mike, is one person to do it well, you know, one person to mount a hologram tour that is, like, really well done, that does, that's respectful, that, it caters to the fans and all that stuff. And I wonder if that happens, if people will start to get used to it. And then there's younger generations as well who maybe don't have firsthand knowledge of the people when they were alive. You know, they're maybe not as averse to technology. I don't know. I really think that that could be something that becomes a thing, like, in the next decade.
Right. Well, ABBA just announced, not that ABBA is necessarily classic rock, but ABBA is going to be doing a hologram tour, I think, starting in December. They've just released two new tracks, or they will be releasing two new songs. I think Elvis did that, didn't he? They had a hologram of Elvis, and then they had the original, or the surviving members of the Jordanaires on stage performing live, which was kind of a cool idea.
Yeah, I mean, was that a hologram or just like a video projection?
You're right. I think it was just a video projection. You're right.
But still, it's the same thing. Like you're kind of going to an arena to watch someone on television.
Exactly.
Which is kind of weird, but you know, there is something with this music where we talk about nostalgia. And I think there's certainly an element of nostalgia with people who grew up with this music. And there may be even an element of nostalgia for me who, like, you know, I didn't see a lot of these bands firsthand in their primes, but it does remind me of my childhood in a way. So, you know, maybe I'm also nostalgic for something I didn't even experience firsthand. But it'll be curious to see, like, if the Beatles at some point make the transition from being this sort of, you know, music that we associate with a certain group of people making it to almost like classical music where, like, they're the composers and then you go see, like, repertory bands perform the music. You know,
right.
An orchestra, it's like a four-piece band. And maybe that'll happen in 100 years. Like, instead of going to a concert hall to see Mozart, you're going to go see a four-piece band play the Beatles. You know, I don't know. That's curious to contemplate.
So we're looking at a fairly narrow time frame here before, well, as I mentioned off the top, we have a slew of bands that are going to be sort of performing one last year. It'd be a kind of a protracted goodbye for people like Paul Simon and Elton John. I think Elton John's so long tour is going to last something like 2 years.
Right.
And then there will be a time when they're all gone. But what about the there are what I'm encouraged by is there are new bands coming up that sound like old bands. Greta Van Fleet and Rose Hill Drive and Primal Scream. Some have compared them more Rolling Stones than the Rolling Stones. Are you encouraged by the new crop that's coming up? Let me just get you to hold on to that thought. We'll take a time out, come back, and continue our conversation with Steve Hyden, rock journalist and the author of Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. We'll come back and continue to delve into this. Here are the Who and Be Lucky on Coast to Coast AM. All right. Hey, Boston Dynamics has posted a new video of its advanced humanoid robot. It's called Atlas, and you can see it performing several tasks with uncannily human-like movements in the footage. Atlas can be seen running outside in a park-like setting over uneven terrain, jumping at a log obstructing its path. Atlas, another Boston Dynamics project, Spot Mini Robo Dog, inspire both admiration and fear among some who see the robots as a step closer to the bleak futures envisioned in Black Mirror and The Terminator. And you can see that video for yourself. See Atlas Run, where our webmaster tonight, Sean Lattersore, has posted that in the carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. Hey, I want to keep you up to date with what's going on with George Noory, our fearless leader, and some of his upcoming live events. KXNT Radio and Danheiser Wagner Entertainment presents George Noory Live, Rolling the Dice in Vegas, Saturday, June the 9th, from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Silverton Casino Hotel in Las Vegas, including ufologist, classified documents, and Area 51 expert John Greenwald, investigative journalist, news anchor, and Coast to Coast AM's very own George Knapp. The man who died twice, was hit by lightning, and lived to tell about it, Danion Brinkley. And a special guest appearance by 13-year-old Adam Garcia and the healing powers of his crystal grid. Singing, George will also, of course, be singing with a live band. There'll be an audience Q&A with each guest. And then after, there'll be a meet and greet to follow the show. So don't miss out. Tickets are going fast. So for your ticket information, you can go to coasttocoastam.com or you can call the Silverton Casino Hotel directly at 702-263-7777. Again, the Silverton Hotel, 702-263-7777, and then hit #4. Back to my conversation with Stephen Hyden, as we discuss his book, Twilights of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada, affiliate In-Depth Radio News Talk 1010. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. Coming up top of the hour, James Abbott, The Outsider's Guide to UFOs. Right now, Steve Hyden stays with us, rock journalist and author of Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. And one of the classic arguments that certain bands should just shut it down, stop touring, stop recording, is that by going on, they're sort of diminishing or undermining their legacy. So let's, for example, take the Rolling Stones, who I, for the record, I think they sound better now than they did, probably than they did 30 or 40 years ago. But how do you respond to that argument that they, if they release another album and it won't hold up to, I don't know, Aftermath or Her Majesty's Satanic Request, they're undermining their own legacy?
Well, you know, on one hand, I think there's some validity to that, especially if you compare them to the Beatles. You know, the Beatles were a band, you know, they were putting out records for about 8 years or so. And, you know, depending on your feelings about Yellow Submarine or like Magical Mystery Tour or something, I mean, they never really put out a bad record. Yeah, they have like a really great sort of discography that's excellent from beginning to end. And the Rolling Stones, you know, you can't make that argument, you know, for them at all. There's a lot of people who would say, you know, that their last great record was Some Girls, and that was 40 years ago. I happen to be a big fan of Tattoo You, which was a couple years later, but I would be hard-pressed to argue any album after that as being, like, a great record. So, you know, we're really talking, like, you know, several decades of putting out, like, okay records, but, you know, nothing approaching their classic stuff. But I also feel like as time goes on and people look back, they tend to edit out the records that they don't really like. You know, so like when we talk about the Stones, people tend to focus on their glory years, which, you know, depending on your point of view, would, you know, starts like in the mid 60s, like with Aftermath, as you mentioned, and goes up until about Exile on Main Street or so. And then there's some great records after that, but it gets a little spotty. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that because the Stones are touring now, that they are somehow going to be looked at like as a less great rock band. Like, I don't feel like anything that the Stones put out now is somehow going to make Sticky Fingers sound worse. You know, there's also something about classic rock to me where if you come to it as I did later on through the radio, I really think that these bands, in a way, become fixed in time. You know, I said that earlier, but, you know, there's a difference to me with the Stones versus a band, say, like Pearl Jam that I grew up with, where I can see how Pearl Jam has aged through the years, because when they were young, I was young. So, like, when I see Eddie Vedder look older, I also see myself look older. With a band like the Stones, they're still a band that kind of exists in my imagination. You know, like, I know Mick Jagger's 75 or so, but in my brain, he is always going to be the guy, you know, in the liner notes of, like, Let It Bleed or Beggar's Banquet. You know, that's the band that I encountered at a certain age, and that's still the band as it is in my mind. And this is something I explore in the book. I mean, I think that there's an element of imagination, in a way, with these bands. Even when you see them in the flesh, even when you see how much older they are, I think people kind of project an idea of what these bands are that kind of supersedes the reality of what they see.
Right. That's an excellent point. I agree. I think I do the same thing when I go to see the Rolling Stones or Paul McCartney. Although, I have to say, when it comes to McCartney, I think there's been a real resurgence. I think, for example, albums like Chaos and Creation in the Backyard, which came out just about, well, what, 10, 12 years ago, and the follow-up to that, Memory Almost Full, I think those two albums are just stellar and really hold up to almost anything he's done since he left the Beatles. What do you think?
Yeah, I love a lot of the Paul McCartney solo stuff. And, you know, a fascinating thing about McCartney, I think, is that a lot of his solo records that he put out in the 70s, you know, they were not critically acclaimed. You know, they were dismissed at the time as being sort of slapdash, you know, a little half-baked. I'm referring to records like his first self-titled record, the one with the bowl of cherries on the cover, that record Ram that he did with his wife, Linda. And now, like, I think especially among younger generations, you know, Gen X fans and millennial fans, those albums are looked at as masterpieces. And you listen to an album like Ram, you know, I think critics at the time were expecting McCartney to remake Abbey Road or, you know, these great Beatles masterpieces. And what McCartney did, I think very deliberately, was to sort of scale down the expectations of what he had done in the band. And he was creating these sort of like homey, handmade-sounding records that were, you know, it sounded like a guy just kind of playing around in his home studio. And I think at the time, critics were sort of offended by that. They felt like he wasn't trying very hard. But you listen to those records now, and they sound like early indie rock. You know, they sound like Pavement or Guided by Voices. You know, it really kind of, they were kind of forward-looking in their way about, like, the kinds of rock records that would be sort of in vogue decades after the fact.
You just reminded me that I failed to follow up on a question I asked you before the break, and that is, when we're talking about the future of classic rock, rather than the subtitle of your book, which is A Journey to the End of Classic Rock, and whether these new bands that sound like old bands, up here in Canada, we have a band called the Sheepdogs out of, I think they're out of Winnipeg, or maybe it's Regina. Now I'm going to catch hell from listeners because I got the wrong hometown. But, you know, to me, they kind of have that Allman Brothers sound. And then you've got Greta Van Fleet, which, you know, sound all the world like Led Zeppelin. And you've got Rosehill Drive and Primal Scream. I mean, how do you feel then about the future of classic rock in the hands of bands like these?
Well, like in my book, I talk about how I feel like a lot of the bands that are that exist now, I feel like it's sort of like a post-classic rock era in the sense that, to me, I associate classic rock with a time when rock bands were more ubiquitous than they are now. It just in terms of sort of like the cultural attention, and that's why I kind of put it the end point at the end of the 90s, because I think that was the last time when rock bands got the kind of mainstream exposure that would allow them to be, sort of these arena rock, multi-million selling type bands. Whereas now I think rock is more of a subculture again, in the way that it was maybe in the 60s, where there's still a lot of great bands, but it's more of almost like an alternative to pop music than pop music, the way it was in the latter half of the 20th century. Like you mentioned Greta Van Fleet, I think they're a really interesting case because those guys are all like 18 to 21 years old, and as you said, they sound exactly like Led Zeppelin. So I think that speaks to how that music has endured among younger generations, that there's still kids that go through a Zeppelin phase, and like make Zeppelin sounding records. And, and I like Greta Van Fleet for what they are. I think they're a little derivative, to put it lightly. I tend to prefer artists like a Courtney Barnett, who I think you can listen to her records and you can hear how she's part of the continuum of classic rock. You can hear elements of like all the great bands of the 60s and 70s. But I think she's doing it from a perspective that is drawing on the roots and putting her own spin on it. And not sounding exactly like someone else, but maybe reminding you of somebody while having a very strong personality of her own. And I would also say that's true of like the War on Drugs, which is a band I love, who gets compared to Tom Petty and Bruce Springsteen. But if you listen to their records next to a Tom Petty record, you can tell the difference between the two. But there's sort of like a shared spirit, like a Heartland Rock type spirit that's shared there that's not so on the nose in terms of just kind of replicating something that came before.
And are they releasing on vinyl? And do you see a continuance of this, what seems to be a sort of a burgeoning or a resurgence of vinyl?
I think so. I mean, that's never going to be a dominant force in retail. And, and truth be told, I think the vinyl renaissance or boom or whatever you want to call it, it probably gets a disproportionate amount of attention for the amount of, for the piece of the market that it is. I mean, streaming is obviously the future, it's the present, really. I mean, it has become the dominant way that people listen to music. But, I think at the same time, because of the way the world is now, things don't have to go away. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It's not like, oh, there's this new format now, so we have to get rid of an old format. I think with vinyl, what the popularity of that format speaks to is that there's always going to be a subset of people who want that experience, who want more of a tactile experience, who really like the ritualistic aspects of music. And that's something I write about in my book. Yeah, I write about the mythology of classic rock. This idea that when you listen to these bands, you're sort of plugging into a continuum of music, sort of this idea of like music almost being something larger than yourself that you can become a part of. And vinyl is part of that. And I think there's something to people buying a vinyl record of a new release and putting it next to their Beatles records and Stones records and feeling like, okay, this kind of makes it feel like it's all part of the same story if this is all in my music collection.
Right. I miss liner notes and I miss album art, which
right.
was a real art form. And, I think once the younger generation, they discover those milk cartons of albums. Is that a Canadian thing, or do you store your albums in milk cartons? Milk crates, we used to call them.
I've never personally done that, but yeah, that's not just a Canadian thing. That's okay. In the States as well. I don't know how that got started. I don't know how milk cartons and vinyl records became linked. I mean, milk is not a very rock and roll substance.
That's right.
Boxes or something, or you know, like cases of old cases of beer or something. But I guess they're just sturdy and they can carry the records. So it's an unlikely marriage, but it's been a successful marriage.
Well, and it was ruined up here when we went metric. I remember the day I was working at Kelbeck's grocery store in Brantford. Word went out that the next, you know, the next week they were all converting to metric, the liter bags of milk. And once that happened, you could only store like two albums diagonally in a milk crate. It just totally ruined everything up here. I was depressed for months.
That's when rock and roll died right there.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Not that you have any insider information, or maybe you do, but I mean, are you, like a lot of us, still sort of holding on and hoping and praying for a Led Zeppelin reunion? I think Jimmy Page certainly seems to be.
Well, okay, I don't know if I have insider information, but I actually did interview Robert Plant a couple months ago for my podcast. Oh. And I would say there's less than a 0% chance of a Led Zeppelin reunion. He seems very happy doing what he's doing. He's got more money than God, and he's putting out really great records on his own. His last record, I thought was great, and his last couple I thought have been really great. And I think what he's doing, it's a good example, I think, of, you know, I think, again, when we talk about this classic rock stuff, we talk a lot about nostalgia and sort of like rehashing your hits and catering to an audience that just wants to hear music that they loved 30 or 40 years ago. But there are also people of that generation who are continuing to do new things and just sort of maximize their artistic potential, you know, and I think he's one of them. And, you know, for all the talk that we, you know, that people had, that all these people shouldn't go on the road, you know, you should honor the legacy. Robert Plant actually seems like one of the rare person who agrees with that. You know, I think John Bonham was like one of his best friends. I think it's weird for him to even think about that band,
right?
Without
right.
him, you know, and no matter how much money would be thrown at him. So, as frustrating as it might be for some fans that he doesn't want to do it, you know, you have to respect his fidelity to that idea.
Well, I got to ask you then about Ray and Dave Davies. Are they ever going to bury the hatchet, and are we going to see a Kinks reunion, for crying out loud?
See, I have no information on that. You know, I would love that. You know, they are they are a band that they're at the top of my list of bands that don't have a great documentary made about them that need a documentary. You know, like, we're in this era now where, like, any minor band seems to get their own documentary now, you know, and maybe because I'm watching every single one of them. You know, there are people like me who will watch any documentary about a classic rock band just because it's cool to see footage of rock stars carousing in the 70s, you know, doing various things of mischief. But the Kinks are a major band and they have a crazy history. And I feel like if they had a great documentary, it would help maybe spark more interest in their background, you know, sort of beyond the couple records that everybody knows, because they have so
That's
many
right.
great albums.
Well, in the meantime, we have Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. Steve Hyden, thank you so much. It's been cool hanging out with you, and I hope we can do this again.
Yeah, thank you. This has been great.
Linda Ronstadt, Tumbling Dice, taking us into the break. The Outsider's Guide to UFOs is next on Coast to Coast AM.